Good day, everyone. This is Ed at the Talking Information Center of the Massachusetts Radio Network, bringing you articles from The National Interest magazine. We'll lead off this week with Desmond Lachman's essay entitled, Where is Donald Trump's Affordability Agenda? Desmond Lachman is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. It would be a gross understatement to say that Donald Trump has a major affordability problem in the run-up to the midterm congressional elections. By November, the consumer price index will be higher than it was at the start of his second term. If the Iran war continues and the Strait of Hormuz remains closed, inflation will in all probability be significantly higher than this February's 2.5%. This means that Trump will see his party going into the congressional midterm with the overall price level at least 6% higher than when he started his second term. Worse yet, we could see considerably higher prices and higher price increases for politically sensitive goods such as gasoline, groceries, health insurance, and electricity. If there's one thing we can be sure of, is that Trump will try keep the shifting the blame for today's inflation to Joe Biden. However, this is likely to prove difficult, given that Trump promised to lower the cost of living, and his fingerprints are all over our current affordability problem. He also boosted inflation with his aggressive trade policy. He has also fueled inflation by pursuing a reckless budget policy, undermining the Federal Reserve's independence, and starting a war of choice that has led to both energy and a food price shock. Start with Trump's trade policy. After many twists and turns, including the Supreme Court rejection of the administration's national security rationale for the Liberation Day tariffs, Trump is now imposing a general import tariff of 15% on most U.S. trade partners and a 50% tariff on steel and aluminum imports. This has led to the highest tariff level in the past 100 years. A recent Federal Reserve Bank of New York study found that some 90% of the tariff increases are borne by U.S. companies and households, not by our trade partners, as Trump has claimed. According to the Yale Budget Lab, those tariffs are adding 1.3 percentage points to inflation. On numerous occasions, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has indicated that import tariffs are an important reason why inflation has remained above the Fed's 2% inflation target. In turn, that has forced Fed to pass its interest rate cutting cycle. Trump's macroeconomic policies are hardly helping to bring down inflation. His One Big Beautiful Bill Act has added substantially to the budget deficit. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the budget deficit is set to exceed 6% of GDP. It could rise further if Congress approves the Pentagon's proposals to increase defense spending by $200 billion. Meanwhile, Trump's relentless attacks on the Fed's independence threaten to complicate its efforts to contain inflation. It is concerning that the 10-year Treasury bond has already risen to 4.3%, and mortgage rates are again significantly above 6%. This has incurred as investors lose confidence in the United States' ability to repay its debts and fear that the government will try to inflate its way out of debt. More serious yet has been the energy and food crisis precipitated by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz and by Iran's damage to the oil and natural gas production infrastructure of its Gulf neighbors. The closure of the strait has caused one of the largest disruptions to oil and fertilizer supply on record. The International Monetary Fund estimates that if sustained, a 10% increase in international oil price could add 0.4 percentage points to inflation and subtract from 0.1 to 0.2 percentage points from economic growth. This implies that should oil prices remain at their current levels of around $100 a barrel, U.S. inflation could be over 1 percentage point higher than it otherwise would have been, while economic growth could be more than a half a percentage point lower than it otherwise would have been. Add to this an expected spike in food and electricity prices, and headline inflation could be very well in the 4% range on Election Day. Given the dismal inflation outlook, Trump does the Republican Party but no favors by telling voters that inflation is not a real problem. Instead, he should be telling voters that he feels their pain and begin taking action, like rolling back his punitive import tariffs to show voters he is trying to help reduce inflation. Our next author is Dr. Arman Mahmoudian, who is a research fellow at the USF Global and Security National Security Institute. He writes, "Amid war with Iran, the Arab world is looking for new partners." On March 10th, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth claimed that Iran had made a major error by launching drone and missile attacks against its Arab neighbors across the Persian Gulf. Hegseth argued that Iran had revealed who it was and what it represented through those attacks, and claimed that its Arab neighbors would not rely on appeasing Tehran in order to avoid future attacks. Alongside Hegseth, many other analysts also concluded that Iran's attacks on its neighbors were a costly strategic mistake, arguing that they would push the Arab states of the Persian Gulf closer to Iran's adversaries, Israel and the United States. Rhetoric from the Gulf has matched this perception. On March 18th, senior Emirati officials, including Anwar Gargash, an advisor to the UAE, United Arab Emirates, President Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, argued that Iran's attacks on the Persian Gulf states had pushed them closer to Israel and the United States. It is unclear what motivated Gargash's rare public assessment. On the one hand, he may genuinely believe that this is the direction in which Iran's Arab neighbors are heading as a result of these attacks. Alternatively, he may be using this claim as a shot across the bow to Iran, suggesting that an expanded American-Israeli alignment that includes Arab states could emerge in order to pressure Iran to halt its attacks. Still, none of these warnings stop the continuation of Iranian attacks. It is fair to say that in the post-war era, if the regime survives, Iran's attacks against Gulf states will carry strategic costs. Iran has invested significant time and effort in pursuing détente with Arab states, including its China-brokered rapprochement with Saudi Arabia. These attacks carried out by Iran against its neighbors have set back these efforts and are likely to sour relations for a prolonged period, particularly given the scale of the attacks and the damage inflicted. Given these clear strategic disadvantages, why is Iran continuing these attacks? For Tehran, the benefits of continuing these operations appear to outweigh the risk of pushing Arab states closer to Israel. From Iran's perspective, the war is both existential and asymmetric. Lacking the military capability to directly confront the U.S. and Israel, Iran relies instead on economic means to respond to their pressure. In practice, this means exerting pressure on global energy markets by closing the Strait of Hormuz and targeting its Arab neighbors, leading to economic chaos and fear, prompting Westerners to flee those countries and ultimately inflicting substantial second-order costs on the United States. Yet, this strategy comes at a significant cost. If the Islamic Republic survives the war, it will face the consequence of undermining years of diplomatic effort aimed at achieving détente with the Arab states of the Persian Gulf. This includes, as I mentioned earlier, the China-brokered rapprochement with Saudi Arabia in 2023, as well as the gradual expansion of ties with both the United Arab Emirate and Saudi Arabia. These gains have now been severely damaged, and relations are likely to remain strained for the foreseeable future. How the Iran war could reshape Arab politics? Iran's actions raise a critical follow-up question. While the attacks are clearly damaging their relations with Arab states, how will they shape those states' alignment with the U.S.? Will they strengthen these ties, leave them unchanged, or push them in a different direction? There are multiple scenarios one might envision as a result of the strikes. One is the continuation of the status quo in relations between the Arab states and the U.S., or even its strengthening. Iranian attacks against its Arab neighbors may reinforce their perception of Iran as a serious threat and underscore their need for U.S. support. As a result, these states may choose to double down and expand their military alliances with Washington. After all, the U.S. remains the most powerful actor in the region, and its capabilities can deter a significant portion of Iranian attacks. However, this is not the only plausible outcome. An alternative scenario is that Arab states may seek to distance themselves from the U.S., not by weakening political or economic ties, but by reducing their military dependence on Washington, and in doing so, signaling to Tehran that they are not U.S. proxies and should not be caught up in a U.S.-Iran war. In this case, they would limit further expansion of military cooperation while maintaining existing political and economic relations. This outcome, of course, would effectively mean granting Iran its policy aim through its unprovoked attack, a thought that may be difficult for Arab leaders in the Gulf to stomach. However, these leaders must also contend with the fact that the United States bulldozed ahead with the war in defiance of their objections, raising questions about Washington's reliability as a partner. Prior to the conflict, the Gulf states made serious diplomatic efforts to prevent it. In mid-January, when discussions of renewed U.S. military action against Iran first emerged, Qatar, Oman, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia coordinated diplomatic efforts to discourage Washington from entering another war. The Trump administration ignored their entreaties, and they were drawn into the conflict due to their ties with the U.S. Tehran has made it clear that it views its neighbors across the Persian Gulf as an extension of the United States and Israel and targeted them accordingly. For example, Israel's March 18th strikes on Iran's South Pars gas field triggered Iranian retaliation against Qatar's LNG facilities, liquid natural gas, reportedly disrupting around 17% of its exports. Repairs could take 3 to 5 years, with estimated annual losses of about $20 billion. In response, Qatari officials expressed strong frustration to President Trump, questioning the logic of the initial strike, given the predictable retaliation. This led to an unusual statement from Trump on March 18th, criticizing Israel's action and emphasizing that the U.S. neither supported nor had prior knowledge of the attack. While some damage may be contained through de-escalation, other consequences will be longer-lasting. The economies of the Gulf states depend not only on oil and gas, but also on their role as hubs for global investment and tourism. Their appeal has rested on stability, safety, and predictability. The current war has undermined these advantages. Reports indicate that expatriates are leaving hubs such as Dubai in response to the conflict, some of them permanently, concluding that they and their investments are no longer safe there. As a result, some of the costs imposed on Arab states by a war that they did not initiate may prove irreversible. In this context, Arab states may find themselves in a position where military ties with the U.S. impose significant costs. Might reducing those ties also reduce their exposure to risk? One may argue that weakening military ties with the U.S. would also reduce the support Arab states receive. But skeptics in the Gulf could argue that such support became necessary in the first place because of those same military ties. It is easy to envision a vicious circle. Souring relations with Iran drives its Arab neighbors further into the U.S.-Israel camp, but make those states an even more likely target for retaliation in the next conflict. The Arab world's three security alternatives to the United States. If the Arab states wish to diversify their foreign partnerships away from the U.S., they have three plausible options. The first is to pivot to the east by moving closer to China and Russia, the world's other major powers. This is possible, and in the past some states have explored it, but it has triggered strong backlash from the U.S. For example, when the UAE allowed China to establish facilities at the Khalifa port, it faced extreme American pressure. In addition, the recent Israeli attacks on Iran and earlier American attacks on Russian systems in Venezuela have raised doubts about the reliability of the Chinese and Russian military equipment as an alternative to the U.S.-made gold standard. And while Arab states may want to reduce their military dependence on the U.S., they have no interest in weakening their political and economic ties with Washington. A full pivot toward China and Russia could jeopardize those ties. For that reason, this is not necessarily the most attractive option. A second, more likely option is for the Arab states to deepen regional military cooperation among themselves, pushing the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, further toward something like an Arab NATO. This step is far easier to take and would face no opposition from Washington, which has advocated for stronger intra-Arab security ties for years. Yet this option alone may not provide them with a sufficient sense of security. Even now, despite existing cooperation among themselves and continued U.S. backing, they are still being targeted. This suggests that regional cooperation by itself may not be enough and that some form of external support would still be needed. The third option is to move toward third powers that, on the one hand, still have meaningful military capabilities to offer, but those presence would not provoke the U.S. There are a number of countries that could potentially play this role. The security of the Persian Gulf and the flow of oil exports matter to many states, and some of them do possess useful military capabilities. These nations include certain European countries, particularly the middle powers of Western Europe, e.g., UK, France, Germany, and Italy. Australia, which has maintained a base in the UAE since 2009, India, a rising military power that already enjoys close relations with the Gulf, and East Asian states such as Japan and South Korea. India, Japan, and South Korea are especially important because they also maintain relatively good relations with Iran, and Iran benefits from those relationships. This reduces the likelihood that Tehran would jeopardize those ties by attacking the Gulf states, where many of their nationals live and work, and where joint facilities might be headquartered in the future. It is noteworthy that Iran's strategy is not limited to economic pressure. It also seeks to raise the cost of the U.S. presence in the region to a level that could eventually force Washington to scale back or withdraw. This works because of the dominant American presence in the region. But if other, more neutral nations were present as well, the cost for Tehran could quickly rise as well. Beyond these three options, there's also a hybrid approach. Under such an approach, Arab states would reduce their military dependence on the U.S. while preserving and possibly even strengthening their political, economic, and financial ties with Washington. They could offset any reduction in military dependence, for example, by continuing to buy more American products. At the same time, they would deepen military coordination among themselves through greater regional alignment, stronger command structures, and more integrated control systems. Alongside that, they could bring in third powers such as India, certain Southeast Asian states, and some European countries, states that still have something to offer militarily, but are less likely to become direct Iranian targets. Whichever option, if any, the Arab states choose, will be highly dependent on how the war ends. What is clear, however, is that once the fog of war lifts, they will have to rethink their military posture and alliances in light of the war. They will either double down on the current arrangement, seeking greater American protection, or move to change it. If such a change occurs, the direction of that shift will come to define the Gulf security partnerships for the next generation. Our next article's co-authors are Glenn Van Herk and Ramon Marx. They write, "Drone Warfare Has Come to the United States." General Van Herk is a retired U.S. Air Force general. Ramon Marx is a retired international lawyer and a regular contributor to the National Interest. He is vice chairman of Business Executives for National Security. Amid the raging conflict in the Middle East, the astonishing events at Barksdale Air Force Base earlier this month have attracted only limited media attention. It is reported that swarms of unidentified drones repeatedly loitered over Barksdale between March 9th and 15th, drawing no publicly known effective response from the military or Department of Homeland Security. Barksdale is the headquarters of the Air Force's Global Strike Command, which is responsible for the nation's nuclear, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and strategic bomber forces, including B-2, B-1, and B-52 aircraft. Their base is home to the 2nd Bomb Wing's B-52s and is the central hub of communication and logistical support for coordinating and directing those forces. The fact that potentially threatening drones were able to operate over such a critical complex with apparent impunity over several days after a similar event spanning 17 days occurred more than 2 years ago at Langley Air Force Base is astonishing. Reports indicate that Barksdale personnel were repeatedly ordered to take cover as drones roamed over buildings and aircraft. That there was no reported effective response to that incursion comes as no surprise to those who have been calling for an overhaul of how the U.S. homeland is protected. The truth is that homeland defense today remains largely centered on deterring nuclear threats such as ballistic missiles and bombers flying over northern polar regions, launching ordnance in the United States into North America. Decades ago, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, and the United States Northern Command, NORTHCOM, were organized primarily to deter a strategic attack utilizing weapons of mass destruction. Protected by the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans, the homeland was widely regarded as invulnerable to non-strategic threats. Beginning first with 9/11, the attacks of 9/11, and now with the advent of unmanned aerial systems, UAS, including military-style drones and such long-range precision weapons as cruise, ballistic, and hypersonic missiles launched from space, air, land, sea, and subsea, that comfortable safe haven assumption no longer holds. What happened at Barksdale is not an anomaly, but a forerunner of a new era in warfare. Defense of the homeland has become and will become, continue to be, a far more complex challenge. At Barksdale, as at Langley Air Force Base, the government apparently lacked effective technology to identify and counter the drones. Even if counter UAS capabilities were available, a decision to use them was likely complicated by concern over potential collateral injury to military personnel and civilians and property damage. Some reports indicate that Barksdale could attempt to employ counter UAS jamming, but without success. Their inability to jam could indicate that Barksdale was facing a threat with autonomous or effective anti-jamming capabilities. If accurate, this would suggest that a sophisticated foreign actor was behind the incursion rather than a drone hobbyist. Further complicating the picture is that Washington has not clarified the responsibility and authority over UAS policy on dealing with encountering drones. For a national-level response to a strategic attack, NORAD and NORTHCOM have elaborate and well-known detailed decision-making protocols for national command authority. The decision-making chain is clearly established, reaching all the way to the president. It is designed to operate within minutes. The decision-making process today for responding to a UAS threat or another kind of conventional attack is murkier and nowhere near as settled, often involving several cabinet departments. The military is not even necessarily responsible for taking the lead. For example, in February of this year, U.S. Customs and Border Protection used the Department of Defense-provided high-energy laser to engage what they believed were hostile drug cartel drones operating near Fort Bliss, close to the Mexican border. That led to controversy. The FAA, part of the Department of Transportation, decided that the use of laser made it necessary to issue an emergency order shutting down air traffic over El Paso below 18,000 feet for 10 days, citing unexplained special security reasons and declaring the area to be a national defense airspace. The agency warned that aircraft entering the restricted space could be shot down. After a few hours, the White House, which had not been consulted, intervened and rescinded the no-fly order. Washington said that the threat turned out to be party balloons, not hostile drones. News reports said that there's been some wrangling between the FAA, the Pentagon, and Homeland Security over the appropriate use of a laser in an area with heavy commercial air traffic. The El Paso experience highlights important governance issues regarding how emerging threats such as drones and UAS should be managed. In addition to the Pentagon, the Department of Transportation, Department of Homeland Security, CIR, and the FBI also play a role in such situations, as do other intelligence agencies. As the U.S. comes to grips with the reality that the homeland is not immune to military-style drone, missile, cyber, and other non-nuclear threats, it must reevaluate comprehensively its approach to deal with such situations on a real-time basis. Kinetic and non-kinetic tools must be swiftly introduced at a strategic, critical military and civilian infrastructure locations. The decision-making apparatus necessary to identify and to respond to such threats must also be modernized and streamlined. The bottom line is that the U.S. must move forward towards aggressive to address these new UAS threats and others emerging in the homeland. Legacy approaches defined by stovepipe responsibilities and authorities no longer work. That antiquated framework must be promptly replaced by a collaborative, integrated architectural network that enables fused domain awareness and real-time collaboration among key decision-makers. Joint Interagency Task Force 401 is a solid first step in this direction, helping propel such a reorganization. It calls for full support from all agency stakeholders. That task force should be urgently empowered at the White House level to address policy and capability gaps swiftly. Next up, author Alexander Langlois writes, "In Lebanon, Israel wants dominance, not deterrence." As the American and Israeli war in Iran expands across the Middle East, Lebanon faces its nightmare scenario. Israel has invaded the country once again, supposedly to disarm the Lebanese Hezbollah, its non-state rival to the north. This specific component of the broader war is ultimately critical, as it could become the primary focus of the warring parties in the coming weeks, especially if direct confrontation with Iran yields diminishing returns. It is no secret that Israeli officials have long wanted to apply more pressure on Lebanon to solve the Hezbollah problem. After a year of exchange of fire, Israel opted to invade Lebanon in 2024 to directly combat the group, severely hampering senior leadership. Following the November 2024 truce that was supposed to constitute a true ceasefire, but rather fostered near-daily Israeli strikes on Lebanon, Beirut began the effort of disarming Hezbollah. Different understandings of the now-dead so-called ceasefire's details have hampered that process, with both Israel and Hezbollah looking to take advantage of any possible vector to increase their relative power. Indeed, this dynamic is exactly what many feared a new war was coming. Hezbollah rejected disarmament wholesale at first, eventually agreeing to disarm south of the Latani River. Even as the Lebanese government proclaimed that it had removed Hezbollah's military presence south of the Latani, roughly 10% of sovereign Lebanese territory that spans its contested border with Israel, its southern neighbors cried foul. It promised a new invasion at the turn of 2026 without full nationwide Hezbollah disarmament, even as it directly and openly violated multiple terms of the ceasefire from day one. That operation ultimately never occurred, reportedly due to planning for the broader war with Iran. Thus, Israel's operation in Lebanon can only be understood within the broader context of the regional conflict. Israeli officials may have assessed that any renewed fighting with Hezbollah on a large scale would welcome an Iranian response. Yet while Hezbollah attacked Israel after the killing of Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, the reality is that Israel was very likely planning an assault on the group regardless. In this context, Israel welcomed conflict with both Hezbollah and Iran. Since the Hamas attacks of October 7th, it has employed a new security strategy, externalizing its security in all instances. It has coupled this approach with a strong willingness to use massive force against its enemies occupying neighboring territory to create additional buffer zones along its contested borders. Thus, the defining shift in Israeli security strategy is clear. Deterrence has been replaced by dominance. For Israeli officials, instability in the neighboring countries is welcome if it weakens real or perceived capacities to harm the state of Israel. In Lebanon's case, as with Israel, that approach is presented in its darkest form, a willingness to welcome civil conflict and total state dissolution if its demands are not met. In doing so, it retains the ability to operate at will in these countries, regardless of legal or moral implications, to ensure its security at the expense of any would-be challengers. In Lebanon's case, that means potential civil conflict. For Israeli officials, this dynamic is a win-win because it provides Israel with security one way or another. This strategy incorporates the Dahiya Doctrine, that is D-A-H-I-Y-A, Dahiya, a military strategy of total war that aims to inflict maximum damage on civilian and non-civilian sites alike to realize security, Israeli security aims. In Lebanon, where the doctrine was first developed in the 2000s, that effort means mass force displacement from supposedly Hezbollah-friendly communities. It involves the widespread razing of infrastructure in those evacuated zones, including the use of chemicals to destroy the area's soil. Civilian infrastructure does not receive the protections outlined in international law, leaving homes and apartments, schools and buildings and ambulances, banks, roads, bridges, and power and water sites as targets. Indeed, that is what is occurring in Lebanon today, per Israeli officials, is the extension of the Gaza model. For Lebanon, two scenarios appear most likely in the medium and long term, should the war continue. Israeli leaders, including Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, have said as much. Netanyahu is particularly incentivized to prolong the war due to his corruption trials at home and strong public support for the fight against Hezbollah across Israeli society. In the first scenario, Israel pushes the envelope through its ground invasion, but eventually hits real resistance from Hezbollah. Exporting the Gaza muzzle becomes a nightmare for the country internationally, but it does not stop Israel's military operations or occupation of Lebanese territory. A stalemate, but not a quagmire, persists in the short to medium term as Lebanese government fails to rein in Hezbollah. As such, the risk of a long-term occupation of territory south of the Latani River and the equally long-term displacement of this area's residents increases. Widespread frustration with Hezbollah peaks, but gradually shifts back toward Israel due to its military operations and occupation, which ultimately works to justify Hezbollah's raison d'etre of resistance. In the second scenario, popular support for Hezbollah crumbles, forcing it to shift its stance on its weapons, but not fully surrender its arms. The Lebanese government pushes the issue of normalization talks with Israel and the crackdown on Hezbollah military activities, following its recent decision to ban those activities. These efforts are presented in eventual quiet talks as a concession. Whether Israel will be compelled to stop bombing the country is unclear, but with such moves, Washington could already be pushing Israel to talk in good faith for the bigger prize, the one that U.S. President Donald Trump openly desires. The question here is one of focus. Washington would likely need to end its assault on Iran to shift any focus back to Lebanon. Should it do so, Israel would still likely occupy some Lebanese territory long-term as the countries work out their disputed border in a format that likely benefits Israel, just like the 2022 maritime border deal. At present, the first scenario seems to be the most likely outcome. The broader war in the region has no clear endgame, an issue no amount of public relations work in Washington can fix. The seeds of mission creep have already been planted as Iran refuses to capitulate, and both it and its elements of so-called axis of resistance prove unwilling to yield on when and how the war ends. Still, Trump has shown a penchant for cutting deals when the trends of war do not appear to be favoring him, is more than willing to do so on a moment's notice. Ultimately, how Washington approaches Iran will have a massive impact on developments in Lebanon, highlighting how fighting in the small eastern Mediterranean country could come to define the broader regional conflict. We'll pivot from the Middle East to the Far East in our next article. The author is Sungyul Choi. The title is America Needs Nuclear Power Fast. South Korea Can Deliver. Sungyul Choi is a professor in the Department of Nuclear Engineering and the founding head of Integrated Major in Sustainable High-Level Radioactive Waste Management, pursuing a convergence of engineering and social science education at Seoul National University. Small modular reactors, SMRs, represent a paradigm shift for nuclear energy from bespoke construction to industrial mass production. The premise is straightforward. Build reactors in factories rather than on site. Standardize the design and the cost of nuclear energy should fall. Getting to this point will require dozens of reactor modules, long-term contracts, and fixed schedules. As with any transition to serial production, early units carry higher costs until learning curves take effect. The solution requires both anchor customers prepared to move first and capable suppliers able to deliver at scale. Aligning these elements is the key to unlocking SMR potential. America may be approaching a solution to the demand challenge. The catalyst is not climate policy alone, but the rapid rise of artificial intelligence. AI training and inference are consuming electricity at an unprecedented scale, prompting data center operators increasingly to seek long-term nuclear power purchase agreements. Yet demand alone is insufficient to encourage growth. Equally important is the need for credible manufacturers capable of delivering serial production on time and on budget. America faces a constraint here. America can design advanced reactors, mobilize capital, and maintain a strong position in the competitiveness of the nuclear fuel cycle. However, decades of low construction rates have thinned the domestic supply chain for nuclear-grade forgings, specialized components, certified vendors, and experienced construction workforces. Rebuilding that supply chain is possible, but it will take time. South Korea fills this gap. It is one of the few countries that has preserved an exportable end-to-end nuclear industrial supply chain. Design capabilities, heavy manufacturing, certified suppliers, experienced construction firms, and an operating fleet that continues to refresh skills and vendor qualification. The institutional memory has been sustained through continuous domestic construction and tested in complex projects in the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Czechia. This capability translates most directly into manufacturing leverage. The economic promise of SMR rests on serial production. Korea's heavy industrial firms, particularly Doosan Enerbility, have positioned themselves as manufacturing foundries for SMR components, attracting interest from multiple international developers. If the U.S. seeks more energy for AI data centers, it will favor suppliers already embedded in the nuclear quality assurance regimes rather than rebuilding every capability from scratch. Korean firms can compress the lengthy and costly qualification process by exporting certified components, proven production processes, and, crucially, the capacity for repetition at scale. Engineering expertise provides another layer. For example, KEPCO, K-E-P-C-O-E-N-C, it's a company, has developed sophisticated capabilities in nuclear steam supply systems, design and balance of plant engineering, areas where many SMR developers face design maturity gaps. NSSS, that's Nuclear Steam Supply System, design demands precise integration of reactor physics, thermal hydraulics, fuel design, structural mechanics, and water chemistry under extreme operating conditions. BOP, balance of plant, BOP engineering, often underestimated, determines whether a nuclear design can actually be built economically and maintained reliably. Korean engineering firms bring decades of refinement in both domains, shortening the path from conceptual design to construction-ready documentation. Construction matters equally. American nuclear projects have struggled not only with concrete and steel, but also with managing thousands of interfaces, welding qualifications, documentation control, supply logistics, nonconformance resolution, and scheduled delivery. While SMRs produce simpler construction than large reactors, serial deployment still requires disciplined execution across multiple sites and regulatory jurisdictions. Korean construction firms, such as Hyundai E&C, offer systematic execution honed through continuous domestic and international projects. If SMRs are deployed in fleets rather than one-off demonstrations, this repeatable construction capability becomes essential. Korea has put real money on the table. Since 2021, major Korean firms, including Doosan Enerbility, Samsung, GS Energy, DLENC, SK, HD Korea, Shipbuilding and Offshore Engineering, and Hyundai, have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in the U.S. SMR developers such as NuScale, X-Energy, TerraPower, Holtec, and other U.S. companies. Korea Hydro and Nuclear Power has signed strategic memorandums of understanding with multiple developers, including Centrus, as part of a consortium with POSCO International. These investments have secured manufacturing rights, component supply contracts, EPC agreements, and technology partnerships. The Korean industry is an integrated partner ready to deliver at scale. What would further credible U.S. Republic of Korea cooperation require? First, cooperation requires co-located manufacturing structured around American assembly with Korean tooling. The U.S. seeks jobs, resilience, and domestic industrial capability. Korea seeks scale and market access. The compromise is to locate final module assembly and integration in the U.S. while importing proven tooling, procedures, and early batch components from Korea until domestic capacity matures. This mirrors how aerospace and automotive supply chains globalized without surrendering national control of final products. Second, effective procurement requires coordination with data center demand. SMR economics improve dramatically when developers secure repeated orders of identical designs. U.S. hyperscalers, utilities, and federal sites can anchor that demand. Korea can provide the industrial throughput to meet its delivery schedules. What is missing is a procurement framework that converts expression of interest into committed repeating orders. Korean manufacturing precision achieves its greatest impact when backed by American demand sufficient to justify investment in production lines. Third, regulatory and codes and standards interoperability is essential. The U.S. licensing system is evolving to a greater speed without abandoning rigor. Korea's competitive edge is partially embedded in standardization and supply chain qualification. Joint qualification protocols and shared quality documentation could reduce duplication in vendor audits and documented cycles, leading to more predictable review timelines until full NRC oversight. This would compress deployment schedules while preserving U.S. regulatory authority and the cost advantages of serial manufacturing. Fourth, nuclear supply chains must be treated as national security infrastructure. U.S. energy policy is increasingly tied to industrial strategy, defense, and geopolitical competition. Nuclear power is now judged not only on emissions reduction, but on resilience, export competitiveness, and strategic influence. In that context, allied supply chains matter. A U.S. Republic of Korea nuclear partnership serves as a resilience strategy, diversifying the democratic world's nuclear manufacturing base, reducing single points of failure, and building surge capacity for both civilian and strategic needs. Fifth and finally, nuclear research and development, R&D, and human resources development must be treated as a shared investment. Joint research programs, personnel exchanges, and shared training among U.S. national laboratories, universities, and Korean institutions can build the human capital required for serial SMR deployment. A manufacturing partnership without a workforce strategy is not durable. For Korea, the prize is not simply exports. It is a chance to lock in a role in the next generation of nuclear standard setting and global deployment. For the United States, the prize is speed, reactors operational and delivering power before the AI boom becomes a grid crisis. Korea possesses the proven manufacturing and construction capacity. America needs to deliver SMRs on accelerated timelines without constraining U.S. long-term industrial sovereignty. What matters now is execution. This means joint ventures co-locating Korean tooling with American assembly, fleet procurement commitments that justify production line investment, and regulatory frameworks that recognize Korean component certifications, shared R&D programs, and workforce pipelines. The window is narrowing. AI's data centers are now being planned. Grid capacity is tightening. Korea has the capacity. America has the demand. The question is whether both can align fast enough to matter. Next up, Absus Sabur Sheikh. is the author of Making the Case for Fusion Energy in the Middle East. Abdus Sabur Shaikh is a researcher in nuclear fusion materials at the Imperial College London and co-founder of the Indijmaj Group. Demand across the Middle East is rising rapidly as populations grow, cities expand, and energy-intensive sectors such as desalinization, cooling, digital infrastructure, and heavy industry scale up. Reliable electricity supply will increasingly shape the region's economic growth and political stability. According to the International Energy Agency, power demand across the Middle East is expected to continue increasing significantly over the coming decades. The Middle East's energy constraints. Recent regional instability has exposed a structural weakness in the region's energy model. Electricity demand is rising each year, yet much of the system still depends on fuels whose supply, price, and export routes remain exposed to geopolitical disruption. At the same time, structural drivers of demand, including cooling, desalinization, urban expansion, data centers, and industry, are pushing electricity consumption even higher. Burning hydrocarbons for domestic power reduces export capacity in economies that still rely on hydrocarbon revenue. Solar and wind contribute to decarbonization, but they do not solve the region's baseload electricity needs. They are intermittent, land-intensive at scale, and require major storage or backup generation to support continuous loads such as desalinization and heavy industry. Desalinization itself requires a large and continuous electricity supply. The IEA notes that desalinization already accounts for a significant share of Middle Eastern energy use, and its share is set to rise further. Nuclear fission, F-I-S-S-I-O-N, can provide baseload electricity, but it introduces other challenges. The United Arab Emirates Baraka plant shows that fission can be deployed in the region, but this brings long-lived radioactive waste, complex fuel cycle questions, and proliferation sensitivities that remain politically difficult in the Middle East. That is the constraint that the current crisis has exposed. The region, therefore, needs a power source that is dense, scalable, reliable, clean, and less exposed to geopolitical risk. Nuclear fusion as a strategic energy system. Fusion, F-U-S-I-O-N, energy avoids many of the constraints that complicate current energy systems in the Middle East. Fusion produces energy by combining hydrogen isotopes, such as deuterium and tritium, rather than splitting heavy atoms as nuclear fission. This reaction produces no carbon emissions during operations, generates minimal long-lived radioactive waste compared with fission, and does not create plutonium or other materials associated with nuclear weapons programs. These characteristics address several of the region's political or technical constraints. Fusion reactors do not require uranium enrichment infrastructure or fuel reprocessing, two areas that have historically created proliferation concerns in civil nuclear programs. At the same time, fusion provides the kind of dense baseload electricity normally associated with nuclear power, while avoiding many of the waste and safety issues that accompany fission technology. Fusion fuel is also abundant. Deuterium can be extracted from seawater, while lithium, used to breed tritium fuel inside reactors, is widely available around the world. The energy density of fusion reactions is extremely high compared with fossil fuels or renewables, allowing reactors to produce large quantities of electricity from relatively small amounts of fuel. For energy systems that must support desalinization, heavy industry, and large urban populations, this combination of reliability, energy density, and fuel security is difficult to replicate with other technologies. Nuclear fusion is on the cusp of introduction. Fusion energy is rapidly moving from laboratory research towards industrial development. More than 50 private companies are now developing fusion reactors worldwide, and the sector has attracted more than $9.8 billion in private investment, according to the Fusion Industry Association. In the past year alone, more than $2.6 billion in new capital has entered the sector as governments, venture capital funds, and technology investors accelerate development. National programs are also expanding to support commercialization. The U.S. has launched a national fusion energy strategy aimed at accelerating private sector development, while the U.K. is pursuing a prototype fusion power plant through its STEP program. In Europe, new ventures such as Proxima Fusion are translating decades of scientific research into commercial reactor designs. The company recently secured support from the German state of Bavaria as part of a multi-billion euro initiative to build a fusion demonstration facility and advance Europe's first commercial Stellarator power plant. Private industry is increasingly driving the sector's momentum. Companies such as Commonwealth Fusion Systems and Proxima Fusion are developing next-generation reactor technologies while attracting investments from some of the most influential figures in the global technology and finance. Commonwealth Fusion Systems has attracted backing from major global investors, including Bill Gates via his Breakthrough Energy Ventures, and strategic participation from Jameel Investment Management Company through the Jimco Technology Fund. Both firms invested in the company's $1.8 billion Series B financing round to accelerate the commercialization of fusion energy. Helion Energy, backed by OpenAI chief and executive Sam Altman, has raised hundreds of millions of dollars and secured an agreement to supply fusion electricity to Microsoft data centers later this decade. How the Middle East can position itself in the global fusion industry. The number of actors shaping this industry remains relatively small. A handful of companies, investors, and governments are now defining the technologies, supply chains, and industrial ecosystems that will underpin future new fusion power. For the Middle East, a region that historically shaped global oil markets, the strategic opportunity is clear. Entering the fusion ecosystems now will allow regional states to participate in building the next global energy industry rather than simply importing technologies developed elsewhere. The practical question for Middle Eastern governments is how to engage with the fusion sector while the sector is still forming. Participation does not require waiting for commercial reactors to arrive. Instead, states can begin by allocating capital through sovereign wealth funds into leading fusion companies, funding joint research partnerships with international laboratories and universities, and positioning regional industries within emerging supply chains for advanced minerals, materials, rare minerals, cooling systems, and precision manufacturing. At the policy level, regional governments can incorporate fusion into long-term energy and industrial strategies by supporting research centers, workforce development, and regulatory frameworks suited to future fusion facilities. These steps will not be easy to take, and as time goes on, competition both within the region and outside it will increase. But the countries that take these steps now will be better positioned to attract pilot projects, build industrial capability, and participate in shaping the institutions and markets that will govern the technology in the decades to come. Next up, author Suzanne Loftus is an associate professor of national security at the National War College and a senior research fellow for Foreign Policy Research Institute's Eurasia program. She writes, "Why Russia is Worried About the Iran War." On February 28th, the United States and Israel launched a large-scale bombing campaign against Iran, killing Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and dozens of the country's senior leaders within the first day. According to the Trump administration, the objectives of this campaign is to degrade Iran's ability to wage war. This includes degrading its nuclear enrichment program, its missile development systems and capabilities, and its ability to arm proxy forces throughout the Middle East. Iran responded by attacking U.S. bases across the region as well as neighboring countries. Many commentators and analysts argue that rising oil prices and renewed American attention to the Middle East could give Russia an advantage in its war against Ukraine. While this may prove true in the short term, this view overlooks a potential strategic consequence of the United States' renewed willingness to employ coercive diplomacy and targeted military force to reshape regional power balances. If the U.S. succeeds in significantly degrading Iran's military capabilities and weakening the regime, it could also contribute to a gradual weakening of the geostrategic ecosystem that has helped Russia withstand Western pressure since its invasion of Ukraine. Russia's ability to sustain its war effort depends not only on the battlefield dynamics, but also on a network of political partnerships, economic ties, and military cooperation. This helps Moscow evade Western sanctions, mitigate diplomatic pressure, and reinforce the narrative of an emerging multipolar world order. The strikes against Iran did not occur in isolation. As recently demonstrated in Venezuela, with the toppling of President Nicolas Maduro and the reestablishment of diplomatic ties with the U.S., members of this broader strategic ecosystem may be weakening or reorienting themselves. Assuming the West continues to support Ukraine and maintain pressure on Moscow, the gradual erosion of Russia's coalition partners could reshape the strategic environment surrounding the war and influence its long-term trajectory. Russia's international support network. The Kremlin frames its war in Ukraine as part of a larger struggle against Western domination. This narrative has gained traction in the global South, particularly among victims of Western colonialism or interventions. Russia's continued ability to withstand Western pressure lends credence to the idea of an emerging multipolar world where the West no longer holds as much leverage to shape global affairs. This idea is celebrated by much of the non-Western world and actively supported by a coalition of anti-Western states that some have characterized as the CRINK, C-R-I-N-K is the acronym, groupings of Russia, China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. Together, the CRINK provides an axis upon which to balance Western power, helping one another evade Western sanctions and resist Western military and normative domination. In Russia's war against Ukraine, North Korea has supplied Moscow with ammunition and troops, and Iran has supplied it with Shahed drones and military technology. China has bought vast amounts of Russian oil and provided the Kremlin with dual-use technology. These countries, along with many others in the global south, have served as alternative trading partners for Russia, helping the Kremlin evade sanctions. While it may not be their explicit goal to support Russia's war in the Ukraine, the CRINK grouping is interested in helping Russia sustain itself against Western pressure to weaken the West's relative power. Consequently, Russia has been able to avoid complete diplomatic and economic isolation, leaving the Kremlin better equipped to sustain its war in Ukraine. With respect to the Middle East, Russia has positioned itself as an alternative interlocutor to Western powers. It has maintained a careful balancing act in its relationship with Iran and the Gulf monarchies. This approach has enabled Russia to expand its influence in the region, leading to greater trade and cooperation, while reinforcing the narrative of an emerging multipolar order in which Western primacy is gradually fading. The Ukraine war comes to the Persian Gulf. Potential consequences of the war in Iran include the weakening of Russia's diplomatic balance in the Middle East and its influence over a key partner. Russia's reported intelligence support for Tehran, while Iranian strikes directly impact Gulf states, risks undermining the perception of Russia's neutrality in the region. At the same time, Moscow's inability to provide more direct support to Iran demonstrates the limits of its regional leverage. Meanwhile, a diplomatic opportunity for Ukraine has presented itself. Kiev is now a leading expert at countering Iran-designed Shahed drones due to Russia's extensive use of them in the battlefield. Ukraine is now lending support to the U.S. and Gulf countries facing similar threats, which may strengthen its diplomatic position in the region and possibly secure additional military support. The overt security threat facing Gulf countries is likely to push them closer to the U.S. and Israel. In this context, Russia's diplomatic overtures to mediate regional tensions while simultaneously supporting Iran with intelligence are overshadowed by Ukraine's provision of military and technical support. The Iran war and the U.S. grand strategy. The war in Iran appears to be part of a broader foreign policy shift in the U.S. centered around coercive diplomacy, economic pressure, and targeted military operations to shape the international environment in a traditional great power competition. Rather than focusing on democracy promotion or nation-building initiatives that characterize much of the post-Cold War era, this administration appears to be applying sustained pressure on adversarial regimes to coerce them into cooperating with Russia, with Washington. The larger goal is to reshape the balance of powers in the Western Hemisphere, Europe, and the Middle East in favor of the U.S. and its allies, enabling Washington to focus more resources on the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. faces its most significant long-term challenger, China. With respect to the war in Iran, successful regime change would be very complex and an uncertain undertaking. Nevertheless, the U.S. and Israel may succeed in weakening Iran's ability to wage war and weaken the regime's overall military reach, at least for the foreseeable future. Elsewhere, renewed American diplomatic engagement with Venezuela after the removal of Nicolas Maduro from power affects the orientation of that country, a formerly important partner for Russia in the Western Hemisphere. The Trump administration claims it has its eyes on Cuba next, which has been facing near economic collapse as its main source of economic support in Venezuela has been cut off. Taken together, the weakening or reorientation of these nation-states would represent a gradual fragmentation of the loose coalition of countries that support Russia's geopolitical ambitions. This policy isn't new. Throughout the Cold War, the U.S. also sought to shape the balance of global power through influencing the alignment of other states, at times using explicitly coercive measures. Even if the current aim of the U.S. current U.S. interventions is not explicitly stated this way, such actions can produce broader strategic consequences, much as they did in the past. How U.S. resolves in Iran's changes Russia's Russia's Ukraine calculus. The war in Iran and the removal of Nicolas Maduro from power in Venezuela are moves that may change the Kremlin's perception of American resolve. Demonstrations of U.S. willingness to employ decisive military measures against regimes aligned with Russia could alter the Kremlin's risk calculus, potentially reducing its willingness to escalate in Ukraine or beyond. At the same time, these developments may confirm Moscow's longstanding fear that the U.S. ultimately seeks regime change in states that challenge its interests and may therefore become increasingly skeptical of current diplomatic efforts to end the Ukraine war. While the Kremlin may conclude that its best path forward is to persist with its military campaign, current dynamics suggest Moscow may be operating in an environment of increased constraints on its behavior. With a heightened perception of U.S. resolve, Russia may be discouraged from attempting to test NATO's limits or intensifying its nuclear signaling. If the U.S. and its Western partners sustain current levels of support for Ukraine, these shifts could gradually shape the long-term trajectory of the war. Russia's ability to sustain its war in Ukraine depends not only on battlefield dynamics, but also on the strategic ecosystem that helps it circumvent Western sanctions and evade diplomatic isolation. This coalition helps shape the narrative that the West is no longer dominant in an emerging multipolar world order. If this coalition weakens or realigns because of the use of American hard power, Russia's strategic environment shifts to its disadvantage. With a renewed willingness to use coercive tactics in today's great power competition, the United States can begin to reshape the broader geopolitical landscape by weakening adversarial coalitions. Assuming the West sustains current levels of support for Ukraine and pressure on Russia, these geostrategic shifts could impact Russia's prospects in the war. And that is a wrap-up for this week from National Interest. I do hope that you have enjoyed listening to these articles from the National Interest magazine, and I look forward to bringing you more next week here at the Talking Information Center of the Massachusetts Radio Network. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great day.